We'll hear arguments first this morning in Hutchinson against Proxmire and others. Mr. Kavanaugh, I think you may proceed whenever you're ready.
I am Michael Kavanaugh of Lansing, Michigan, appearing on behalf of the petitioner, Dr. Ronald Hutchinson. This is a civil action by Dr. Hutchinson, a research scientist, against the United States Senator William Proxmire and his aide Morton Schwartz, seeking damages for libel, slander, interference with contractual relations, an invasion of privacy, and intentional infliction of mental anguish. The basis of federal jurisdiction is diversity of citizenship. In March of 1975, Senator Proxmire launched a series of monthly press releases which were designed, according to Senator Proxmire, to focus national attention upon what he considered as the greatest waste of taxpayer money that could be located that month.
Mr. Kavanaugh, could I interrupt you for a moment?
Yes, sir.
You say the basis of the jurisdiction is diversity of citizenship. I take it then that it's state law of some state that forms the substantive basis for your claim of libel and slander.
Yes, Your Honor. Ultimately, state law will be applied.
And what state? Wisconsin?
Your Honor, there are three possible choices: Wisconsin, the District of Columbia, and the state of Michigan. We believe that the appropriate state law to be applied would be the state of Michigan. The petitioner resides in the state of Michigan. The publication was nationwide, but the greatest impact would be in the state of Michigan, and we think that under the Wisconsin choice of law provisions, they would look to the impact of the tort and that Michigan law would be applied.
But it would be a question of Wisconsin choice of law, then.
That is correct, Your Honor. It is our contention, Your Honors, that a review of the press releases issued by Senator Proxmire that are contained in this record, along with the evidence that relates to them, will show that the press releases typically will take a small part of a research project, distort it, and then indicate that the full amount of the research grant was granted for that project. The press releases are typically filled with sarcasm and humiliate the researcher involved. In April of 1975, Dr. Hutchinson was selected for the Golden Fleece of the Month Award. The Golden Fleece issued for Dr. Hutchinson contained defamatory and untrue statements. The following statements, among others, were made. The government paid $500,000 to find out that anger, stopping smoking, and loud noising produced jaw clenching. All this money was given to Dr. Hutchinson of Kalamazoo State Hospital. In fact, the good doctor has made a fortune from his monkeys and in the process made a monkey of the American taxpayer. The press release also stated that Dr. Hutchinson's research work was perhaps duplicative. In the course of the depositions, the respondents have admitted that prior to issuance of the press release, they knew that the $500,000 did not go to Dr. Hutchinson personally, but rather was paid to the state of Michigan and used by the state of Michigan to pay salaries, to pay for supplies, overhead, and similar expenses. As far as the statement that, in fact, the good doctor has made a fortune from his monkeys, the respondents contended in deposition that this was merely a reflection of Dr. Hutchinson's status and power as a researcher, and a reflection of his income, which they claimed was among the highest percentages of income in the United States. In fact, at the time the fleece was issued, Dr. Hutchinson's salary from the state was $30,000, which was the highest at any time covered by the fleece. The period of time he served as a college professor, the salary would have been considerably less. In depositions, the respondents had also admitted that prior to the issuance of the press release, they received statements from the funding agencies that gave the true nature of Dr. Hutchinson's work. The Office of Naval Research and the National Aeronautics and Space Administration particularly gave statements to the respondents which indicated that Dr. Hutchinson had for the first time given those agencies an accurate method of detecting and measuring aggression. The Navy hoped to use their research in training and selecting submarine crews. NASA hoped to use their research in selecting crews for long-range space missions. In addition to the press release, The respondents issued a newsletter in April of 1975, which repeated many of the same defamatory statements. This newsletter was sent to over 100,000 persons, some of whom resided in the senator's home state of Wisconsin, and some of whom did not. A second newsletter was issued in February of 1976, which also referred to Dr. Hutchinson. In addition, Senator Proxmire made statements regarding Dr. Hutchinson's work on radio and television, including the Mike Douglas Show, where the senator referred to Dr. Hutchinson's work as the most outrageous example of wasteful, extravagant, stupid spending. In addition to these activities...
On those broadcasts, am I correct in remembering that Dr. Hutchinson's name was not mentioned?
No, Your Honor, his name was not mentioned, but his work was specified...
Yeah, the answer is yes.
That's correct. Yeah. His work was specified in such detail that he could be identified from what was said. And in fact, there are affidavits in the record, Your Honor, which indicate that people did recognize that Dr. Hutchinson was being referred to. Mm-hmm. The prior press release issued by Senator Proxmire certainly aided in the identification later of Dr. Hutchinson.
Isn't there some question about whether or not there was more than one broadcast? I know you say there were at least two, but...
We know of one other for certain, is the Bob Berry Show, which is referred to in the record. In addition, there may have been other ones. The senator indicated in his deposition that he could not recall if there are other ones. I believe there's some affidavits in the record which we filed from people who indicated that they believed that they heard mention of this sort of thing on other entertainment-type television shows. In addition to these actions, after the press release was issued, the senator's aide made telephone calls to the various funding agencies. During some of those calls, defamatory statements were made, and pressure was apparently exerted on those agencies to cause them to cease funding Dr. Hutchinson's work. Dr. Hutchinson filed suit, and the defendants moved for summary judgment on the basis of the speech or debate clause in the First Amendment. The district court granted summary judgment. The Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals affirmed, holding one, that the press release and the newsletters were absolutely immune under the speech or debate clause, even though they may have contained defamatory material. Secondly, the Court of Appeals held that the radio and television interviews and the calls to the funding agencies to seek termination of the research grants were not immune under the speech or debate clause, but they were protected under the First Amendment.
Didn't the district court make that same conclusion?
Your Honor, the district court would have extended speech or debate, I believe, to those items as well, but it is correct that the district court, in addition, found that petitioner Hutchinson was a public figure and therefore there was protection under the First Amendment.
So the Court of Appeals affirmed that part of the district court's judgment.
The Court of Appeals narrowed the district court's finding. The Court of Appeals found that some activity...
I'm talking about the First Amendment part of it.
Yes, that is correct, Your Honor.
Well, when you talk about findings and so forth, this case went off on summary judgment against your client.
That is correct, Your Honor.
So we're not talking about a finding of fact on a disputed issue where the Court of Appeals affirms on a clearly erroneous basis.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. In fact, one of our contentions is that Dr. Hutchinson is entitled to a trial on the merits so that a jury or other trier of the fact can consider this evidence and any inferences that can be drawn from it.
Could I ask you, as I read the district court's opinion, the district court also reached a state law question of whether these remarks were defamatory.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And ruled that they were not.
That is correct.
Now, this is a state law issue, I take it, isn't it?
Your Honor...
Now, isn't it?
Yes,
you
it is.
You just told that, said to Mr. Justice Stewart that it was going to be local law that would govern this case.
That is
and,
correct.
And if these remarks were not defamatory, what excuse is there for ever reaching the First Amendment issue, at least? I'm not talking about speech or debate.
Your Honor, the Seventh Circuit Court did not reach the state law issue.
Well, what,
it would appear...
I know, but what excuse... isn't it the usual rule you reach non-constitutional issues first?
Yes, Your Honor, I would think that...
Well, what if the Court of Appeals had affirmed the district court on the ground that these remarks were not defamatory? Would there be any constitutional issues in the case?
Your Honor, to speak frankly, I think the court's decision in Paul versus Davis would indicate that the torts involved do not invade constitutional rights.
Well, no, Paul versus Davis is a 1983 case. This is a case based upon state tort law, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor, it is. Your Honor, in Paul versus Davis, the court considered whether invasion of privacy could rise to a constitutional level, and Justice Rehnquist, writing for the court, indicated that there are only certain limited areas in which an invasion of privacy would rise to a constitutional level. Therefore, while we would hope to view this as a constitutional issue, I think realistically that the court has discussed that, at least in dicta, in Paul versus Davis, if not in a holding.
Why should we reach either the First Amendment issue or the speech or debate clause if the district court is right that this wasn't defamatory anyway?
Your Honor, we believe that the district court was clearly erroneous, and we would hope
that...
Maybe
so, but the Court of Appeals hasn't said so. And we rarely disagree with lower courts on what state law is.
That is correct, Your Honor. The Court of Appeals did not reach the issue, and we would hope that the court would remand for a determination on that issue after the court would rule on the...
Why would we rule on them, on the constitutional issue?
Your Honor...
Because we granted certiorari? That maybe is a good answer.
Your Honor, it was an answer I was embarrassed to give.
Yeah.
I think the other answer is that the district court clearly was erroneous on the state law.
I suppose you contend that you're entitled to have the Court of Appeals pass on the question of state law just the way you would in any other appeal from the district court to the Court of Appeals, even though the constitutional question shouldn't be reached.
That is correct, Your Honor. The petitioner has a right to review, and that review should encompass at least the threshold issue. Your Honor, I would like to, in my remarks today, speak to two issues. The first is speech or debate, and the second is the public figure issue. Article 1, Section 6 of the Constitution provides that senators and representatives for any speech or debate in either house shall not be questioned in any other place.
Before you get on to that, is there in your position the notion that whether or not he is a public figure is a jury issue which cannot be resolved by the court?
Your Honor, that would be our position. Our position is that a jury should be allowed to review the facts and the inferences that can be drawn from those facts to decide whether or not the petitioner is a public figure.
Well, then you must mean that, among other things, that that's an issue which cannot be resolved. It's a factual issue which cannot be resolved on affidavits, but only by a trial of the issues. Is that it?
Yes, Your Honor. That it would appear appropriate to reverse the lower decisions and permit the petitioner to have a trial on the issue. In understanding our speech or debate position, it's as important to understand what we do not challenge as it is to understand what we do challenge. We do not challenge any speech by Senator Proxmire. We do not challenge the insertion of a speech in the congressional record. We do not challenge any vote or any action taken in Congress or in committee. We do challenge a defamatory press release that was given massive publicity, two defamatory newsletters that were given similar dissemination, radio and TV appearances, and the telephone calls to the funding agencies to seek termination of Dr. Hutchinson's funding.
Did you say there were 100,000 of these press releases sent out?
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. Each press release was sent to over 100,000 persons.
All in Wisconsin?
No, Your Honor. Some were in Wisconsin and some were in other states.
Does the record show what the spread was?
No, Your Honor. The only statement, I believe, is in Senator Proxmire's deposition where he indicated that some of those press releases were sent to Wisconsin and others were sent outside of the state.
Were those press releases or newsletters?
I'm sorry, newsletters. All of the press releases were sent to the media.
Right.
This court in the recent past has said on at least three occasions that publications or republications outside of Congress are not protected by the speech or debate clause. In United States versus Brewster, a criminal bribery case, the court pointed out that congressmen engage in many activities that are political in nature rather than legislative. Specifically mentioned were newsletters, news releases, and speeches outside of Congress. The court then commented that it has never seriously been contended that these political matters are protected by the speech or debate clause. In Gravel versus United States, private publication of the Pentagon Papers was found not to be essential to the deliberations of the Senate and not part and parcel of the legislative process. Hence, it was not protected by speech or debate. In Doe versus McMillan, it was held that committee members who compiled and voted to publish a report were immune under the speech or debate clause. But the court made it very clear that the speech or debate clause does not protect a private republication of documents introduced and made public at a committee hearing. The court went so far as to say that if a member of Congress republished libel by reading from a record, from a congressional committee record in its home district, he would not be immune under the speech or debate clause. And these recent statements by the court comply with the historical understanding of the speech or debate clause. Justice Story, 145 years ago, in the commentaries on the Constitution of the United States, stated that if a congressman republished a defamatory statement that it was originally made in Congress, he would not be immune. I think it is worth noting how far the defendants have gone in this case beyond the conduct in Doe. In Doe, the defendants acted as a congressional committee, and they did nothing more than prepare the report and vote along with the rest of the House for its publication. Here we have one congressman issuing his own press release and his own newsletters. In Doe, the publication was very limited. It was limited to 1,682 copies that were sent to other congressmen and to the usual offices that receive printings.
Mr. Kavanaugh, what would you say if they just mailed out, the congressional record?
Your Honor, I think then we would have a question of how wide was the dissemination. If the dissemination...
Same mailing list you've got here.
Your Honor, I would think it would not be protected. I think that that is dissemination beyond the legitimate needs of Congress and therefore would not be protected.
But if the Congress, for some reason or other, sent the same copy of the congressional record out...
Your Honor, if it was an action taken by Congress, I believe that it would be mean.
Or
it would
committee.
Be immune.
Or a committee?
Yes, sir. But if it is taken, if the action is taken by an individual congressman and it is disseminated beyond legitimate legislative needs, then it would not be immune. In Doe, in addition to the publication being limited, there was no effort to call attention to it. In the present case, every possible effort was made to call attention to the news release. In short, in the present case, we do not have Congress taking action or a committee taking action. We have one senator issuing a press release, issuing a newsletter, and giving them the widest possible dissemination. This is not immune under the speech or debate clause. If I may, I'd like to turn to the public figure issue. This court in Gertz versus Robert Welch indicated that there are two types of public figure. First, there was the all-purpose public figure, which was described as a person with pervasive power and influence, pervasive fame and notoriety. The Court of Appeals and the parties in this case are in agreement that Dr. Hutchinson does not satisfy that definition.
Now, before you get into this public figure business, or public official, those concepts have been deemed important in the decisions and opinions of this court when the alleged false defamatory material has been published by some instrumentality of the public news media. Isn't that correct? Is there any case here? Is there any case here that holds that the so-called New York Times rules are applicable when the defamatory statement has been made by an individual person, human being?
No, Your Honor. In fact, that is an issue that we have specifically not conceded. The respondents in the brief indicated in a footnote that apparently we had conceded the point that the same standard applies to public or to private defendants as would apply to a member of the media. Your Honor, we do not think that's correct. The court has not yet addressed that issue. Chief Justice Berger, in a recent concurring opinion, pointed that out, that the court had not yet squarely faced that issue. And there is considerable speculation in the legal community that perhaps different standards do apply.
Well, there are
to private
decisions in state courts the other way, aren't there?
Yes, Your Honor, there are.
So it may be that whether or not your client is a public figure is totally irrelevant.
It may well be that way, Your Honor.
You don't brief or argue this basic question.
No, we have not. And the reason that we have not is simply this. New York Times involved both media defendants and non-media defendants.
Yes.
It would appear from the ruling in New York Times that there was an assumption that the same rule would apply to both types of defendants. Now, since that time in Gertz and in the other public figure cases, the court seems to have rather carefully indicated that the defendant was a media defendant.
Mm-hmm.
But, Your Honor, for purposes of argument, we have assumed that the same standard would apply, but I think that the court has not foreclosed the possibility that different standards would apply to the two types of defendants.
And although you've assumed it, you reserve the privilege of arguing that it doesn't.
That is correct.
But you're not arguing it here.
That's correct, Your Honor. The Court of Appeals held that Dr. Hutchinson fell within the second category of public figures, the limited public figures. These were described as people who have voluntarily thrust themselves into the forefront of a particular public controversy in order to influence the resolution of the issue involved. In other places in the opinion, these persons were referred to as persons who had voluntarily injected themselves into an issue, persons who had assumed special prominence in resolution of a particular dispute. The Court of Appeals relied on four factors in finding that Dr. Hutchinson was a limited public figure. First, the court relied upon his solicitation of federal funds. Second, the published articles about Dr. Hutchinson's work. Third, about the stories that appeared about Dr. Hutchinson in local newspapers. Fourth, the court relied upon the fact that it believed Dr. Hutchinson had sufficient access to the media to reply to the statement. To these four grounds, the respondents would add a fifth, which is that Dr. Hutchinson's research department was the subject of a public audit in the state of Michigan after the press release, apparently after the first newsletter, and after the telephone calls to the funding agencies, but prior to some of the other publications.
Well, that's almost like going back to the plurality thing in Metro Media versus Rosenberg, isn't it? If you say something bad about a person and it's published, that makes him a public figure.
I think that's exactly right, Your Honor. It's a bootstrap argument that anyone who is defamed by a United States senator is going to become a public figure, and there's going to be a
certain... By the very fact of his defamation.
Right.
Yes, sir. And he's going to have some access to the media because the media will call him for his response. And so a very public defendant, such as a senator, could make anyone a public figure if that were the test.
Well, the media always could.
That's right, Your Honor. In regard to Dr. Hutchinson's publications, his publications have consisted of four or five chapters in books and several articles that he has published. All of those were scholarly articles setting forth the results of his research. They did not advocate a position on public funding. They did not seek to thrust him to the forefront of any issue involving the continuation of public funding. It's important to note that in Gertz, the court noted that Mr. Gertz had published many articles and many books, yet he was found not to be a public figure. In regard to the articles that appeared in the local papers, in fact, there was only one local paper, and out of the seven stories that appeared, only one can be called a true story. The other six were simply notices indicating that Dr. Hutchinson had been promoted at the university or something of that nature. The publication that there was about Dr. Hutchinson prior to its release was limited solely to one newspaper in Kalamazoo. This is in startling contrast to the publication in Firestone. Justice Marshall in his dissent pointed out that Mrs. Firestone had been the subject of over 80 newspaper articles during the course of the divorce proceedings, yet she was found not to be a public figure. The last item mentioned by the Court of Appeals was the receipt of federal funding. As the brief of Amicus Curiae, the American Psychological Association, points out, over 72% now of research that is related to university is funded by the United States government. If that were the test, we would be making virtually every researcher a public figure. But more importantly than that, merely by seeking public funds, a researcher does not thrust himself into the forefront of any public issue. So we would submit that that cannot be the test.
Mr. Kavanaugh, shouldn't, if he's going to ask for, what do you get, $900,000 or something like that, according to the footnote in Judge Layton's opinion, shouldn't he be prepared to defend in a public forum the appropriateness of that kind of spending by the government?
Your Honor, the $900,000, as I mentioned earlier, and $900,000 is a high figure, or something less than that. It was in the neighborhood of $700,000 or $800,000. But at any rate, the money was paid by the federal agencies to the state of Michigan or to the other sponsoring authority. The research before it is funded is carefully evaluated by the funding agencies in a peer review committee.
Well, it may have been entirely proper. I don't suggest that. But when you do get involved in seeking public funds of that magnitude, isn't it appropriate to consider that you must be prepared to defend publicly the expenditure of that kind of money?
Well,
does that seem reasonable?
I think while the researcher should be prepared to defend his funding, he should not be given the status of a public figure so that he has to rise to the high level of meeting actual malice before he can maintain an action. Because in addition to the researcher defending the action, the agencies themselves that fund it can defend the action. And that's where I think that the public or a congressman should look for justification.
But doesn't he know that this is the kind of thing that is typically a subject of public debate and newspaper articles, and there might be careless comment on
but
where it goes?
But, Your Honor,
the appropriations area.
But, Your Honor, if we accepted that standard, we would be back to the Metro Media standard, which is that it is a matter of general interest to the public, and therefore anyone who happens to be involved in it can be slandered, and he must show actual malice before he can recover. The court has left that.
It's more of a public issue than the public person.
Yes, sir. Your Honor, I would like to reserve whatever time I have remaining for rebuttal.
Thank you. Mr. Kavanaugh. Mr. Raywood.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, a proper assessment of this case, we maintain, requires some examination of the facts of how Congress actually operates. I'd like to review a few of pertinent facts. In the year of the filing of this suit, President Ford had submitted a budget to the Congress of just short of $400 billion. In that budget was some $25 billion allocated for research and development. That year proved to be an all-time high of $76 billion in deficit. The competitors for research and development funds included such national interest topics as energy research, national defense, environment, and health. It is an annual ritual when this budget is submitted to the Congress that a review take place which spans most of the legislative year. That review process is the responsibility first of the Appropriations Committee and many of its subcommittees. It conducts hearings along with formal review process, and a report to the Congress and legislation submitted to the Congress is an informal review process that goes on continually throughout that year. That is, the budget officers in each of these various agencies contact the appropriations staff, and they exchange information, and they are asked to give more support for particular items, to eliminate some items, and to get the budget into what the Congress deems to be a proper shape. In that same process is going on in the House on parallel committees similarly structured.
Now, is this these observations directed at the speech or debate clause, the First Amendment issue, or what?
Principally the speech and debate issue. It also touches upon First Amendment, but principally speech or debate, Mr. Chief Justice.
Mr. Raymond, could you comment just briefly on why we should reach that issue here? If the Court of Appeals could have disposed of the case on a state law ground?
Well,
I take it the Court of Appeals didn't deal with the state law ground at all.
That's correct. When the speech or debate immunity is raised by a senator, and it was in this case on behalf of the senator and his aide, it requires a preliminary investigation or a preliminary determination by the court as to whether or not it appropriately applies, whether legitimate legislative activity is involved. Once that has been raised, and there
you
is...
Think you say that where speech or debate is involved, it is the threshold issue because the senator shouldn't even be in court at all.
That is correct. The court should proceed no further when it makes such a determination.
Shouldn't reach the local law issue at all.
Should not reach the local law, should not reach First Amendment. It is an obligation on the part of the court to first reach that examination.
So under your hypothesis, a court, say the district court here in Madison, would have addressed first speech and debate, then local law, then First Amendment.
That would be the appropriate order, but in order to reach local law, it might first have to determine First Amendment issues.
Why?
Well, if there is no libel, then it need not address First Amendment.
Well, suppose a complaint, in its terms, alleged only that the defamatory statements were made in a speech on the floor of the House or the Senate on a given day and then gave the content of that speech. Would there be anything in that case except speech or debate clause?
There would be nothing in that case, Mr. Chief Justice. That would be a simple determination.
There would be a demurrer type of response to it by the senator.
It would need no evidentiary showing whatsoever. A demurrer type operation would be sufficient. It would merely need to plead the speech or debate clause on the averments in the complaint.
On your approach, on that hypothetical, the senator or congressman might write a letter rather than filing a formal answer saying, on the face of the complaint against me, I am not required to answer in any place other than the Senate or the House itself. And that would suffice in your view?
Perhaps it might, but I would think that the senator would observe legal procedure like any other litigant and raise that issue preliminarily. But he might choose not to answer at all, and it would then be incumbent upon the court to examine that complaint and see whether or not it was immune. I have been describing an annual ritual of some rather major proportions in the Congress. I want to emphasize that that is the principal business of the Congress and takes up most of its legislative year. Now, turning to Senator Proxmire. Senator Proxmire is a member of the Senate Appropriations Committee, and he serves on five of its subcommittees. Those five subcommittees have control, or at least pass upon, 60% of the national budget. They pass on 75%.
Mr. Maywood, as I understood your brief, you'd make precisely the same argument if Senator Proxmire was not a member of any of these committees. Is that right?
That is correct. That any member has this right, but it's certainly more particularized in his responsibilities. And if there is to be any examination made of his conduct...
Every senator has an interest in avoiding waste of government funds, so I don't understand what the committee membership has to do with the case.
The committee membership was one of the findings below. It certainly explains if any examination is to be made of Senator Proxmire. But I agree with you, Mr. Justice Stevens, that that right rests in all congressmen, and it is one that the Congress protects. In addition to these committee assignments, though, I would like to mention one additional assignment he has. All of these subcommittee assignments span span the particular agencies which received a fleece. But in addition to that, he has an assignment on the Joint Economics Committee, and he is chairman of its Priorities in Economy and Government. That committee, curiously, may not propose any legislation. It has purely an informational function. It publishes a number of reports, but its most popular one is its monthly economic indicators. It is widely circulated, and as I say, has an informative function only. Senator Proxmire has been in the Senate for 21 years. It has been a hallmark of his representation that he has always criticized waste and government efficiency. After 16 years in Congress, he made the decision that he could be much more effective in that criticism if he narrowed his focus and made some particular or dramatic representation of waste in government. Billions have no relation or have no sense to the public as a whole, or even that matter to economists. But some particular item that the government has paid twice the amount of its retail value does have a lot of meaning. He has chosen a pattern of making a speech and also issuing a simultaneous press release for the widest possible coverage. He has explained in his deposition the reason why he does this is that debate and speaking on the floor is not a debating process in the modern Congress. Senators do not attend speech and debates. They do not read the congressional record, or they are not apt to generally, but they do read the newspapers about what has occurred in Congress. And they do listen to their constituents about what their constituents are concerned about in Congress. It is that manner, and in that manner, he feels that he can be most effective in his criticism of spending. Now, these have been characterized as defamatory and or mischaracterized, I believe, as defamatory. But before we reach that issue, I would like to show how each of these...
Well, it's your position that he cut these things.
That is correct. If he is properly executing the legislative function, which has been authorized by the Congress.
He certainly could in a speech on the floor of the Senate.
Without question.
What if he made a commencement speech at the University of Michigan where Dr. Hutchinson was employed and said all the same things?
Well, possibly yes, probably not.
Probably not protected.
Probably not protected. We draw a distinction in this case, and I think you, Mr. Chief Justice, put your finger on, or at least our element of the case, our major emphasis, when you asked Mr. Kavanaugh whether he would concede as to whether a publication authorized by the Congress would be protected. He said, in his view, it would be. It is our position that this particular release through newsletter and through press release is a matter specifically authorized by Congress.
Well, that's in general. That's in general, I take it, as it, because congressmen and senators are authorized to frank their communications to their constituents. Is that what you mean? This particular release wasn't approved by Congress.
That is correct.
Or by any committee, for that matter.
That is not correct.
Why?
A procedure has been established in 1973, after this court's opinions in its 1971 and 72 session. A procedure was established for mailings. That's in 39 U.S.C. 3210. The first thing that was placed in that statute was first to express the intent of Congress. Was the intent of Congress to inform the public, and that was part of its legislative process. Then it said congressmen may mail certain items.
Right.
They may not mail political items. They may not put in personal information. Then it established the procedure for complaints, and it also established the procedure for review. As petitioners pointed out, they don't review them for the accuracy of the statements.
What I'm asking, was this particular publication approved as it was written by a committee?
It was approved because it was mass mailed. It was sent to the Senate Service Department for approval as to whether it conforms to these statutory rules that were enacted in 1973. In that manner, we maintain that this has been conduct that has been authorized by Congress, and for that matter, it is protected. Now, it would
Do you think that matters entirely in the hands of Congress, that Congress could have passed a statute saying that anything that a congressman or senator wants to mail anywhere at any time is protected, regardless of how defamatory it is?
That would be too broad. What we do maintain is that this court should give due deference to Congress in the way Congress operates, in the way Congress says it operates. Congress understands best how to perform its functions. The court is willing and has frequently given due deference to legislative schemes that the Congress establishes. When the Congress itself defines how it is to operate, we say that a substantial amount of deference should be given to Congress. There may be some determination initially by this court in its authority to review all acts of Congress, even its own functions.
Do I understand you to suggest that Congress, by a legislative enactment, can broaden, expand the scope of the speech or debate clause?
The speech or debate clause is broad, but Congress helps to define that. And Congress helps
to... Who defines it finally?
Well, certainly this court must pass on the scope of speech or debate. But in arguing due deference, it seems to me that the court should give wide latitude to Congress in its explanation of its functions. As I said, it understands what its obligations are best. And some review process is necessary.
Well, but when you're talking about deference, basically, this is a case that could have been in, for all practical purposes, for the issues here, been brought in the state court in Wisconsin. And so the ultimate question is whether the state of Wisconsin, in enforcing its libel policy or its slander policy, is foreclosed from enforcing it by the speech and debate clause of the United States Constitution. It isn't a question of this court giving due deference to the senator or the House.
Well, this court, of course, is the ultimate authority on defining legitimate legislative activity.
Well, it's up to us in this case to decide the question that my brother Rehnquist, accurately, I think, says is posed by this case.
That is correct.
Can the state of Wisconsin enforce its policy expressed in its tort law, in this diversity case, in defamation slander cases, in these circumstances, despite the speech and debate clause? And that's a decision that's a question that this court has to answer in this case.
That is correct.
But your submission is, I take it, that that the senator may, in his newsletter to his constituents, tell knowing and deliberate falsehoods about other people and be immune. That even if this is the grossest kind of defamation under Wisconsin or local law, that the senator is immune from distributing these statements in his newsletter. That's your submission.
Certainly that's viewing it in its harshest light, but I would have to agree.
Yes, that's the basis on which we must review the case, isn't it?
Not entirely,
since
the court has held that it was not defamatory material. That could,
who held that?
The district court.
Well, that's the end of the case then. If we accept
that, that's never been reviewed by the Seventh Circuit.
No, it has not.
So I think we must, on the speech or debate issue, you certainly can't object to our viewing the case on the basis that this is the grossest kind of defamation.
I would have to agree. And that is the issue posed when speech or debate has been initially raised.
I agree with you. And would you say the senator is immune at the rostrum in his home district if he gets out his newsletter and reads it?
We would make a distinction between what has been authorized by Congress, what is in the means, and how Congress has defined its particular function.
Well, what do you say about the radio and television broadcast?
We have advocated to what is specifically authorized a per se approach. The TV appearance was not authorized by Congress. In that instance, an ad hoc approach might be necessary. A more thorough examination of the material of that television broadcast was the congressman or was the senator in that program serving legitimate legislative needs?
Isn't your position not to be determined by us? It's your position that staff person that this was handed to decide as to whether this is congressional action or not.
Well,
is that your position?
In a sense, yes.
Do you think Congress can give to a person that is neither a congressman nor anything else that authority?
And if there are disputes, that is supposed to be referred to the Rules Committee. But quite frequently, the Senate Service Department returns mail or returns newsletters and says that does not conform to our rules.
Now, where are their rules?
The rules are contained.
All the rule says if nobody complains, it goes out. Isn't that what the rule says?
No, the Senate rules in
says what?
In Rule 25 and Rule 48
says what?
Places authority, screening authority.
May I see the rule?
The screening, first of all, the Rules Committee.
Do you have anything that's filed here?
Yes, it has been cited in our briefs.
And where? Well,
we have a portion there on how Congress actually operates. I don't want any misconception about this.
We do know, don't we, that any congressman, any senator, can put a piece of paper in the congressional record, and nobody objects. We know that, don't we?
I know of no limitation on that.
Right.
You may put it in the congressional record. And
congressional approval?
He needs no. There is no censorship imposed on members. But before we leave that, Mr. Justice Marshall, I don't mean to represent that the Senate Service Department does a censoring to screen out information. It
but
does. Yes.
Yes. Anybody in the Senate.
Yes, there is a self-policing policy. First, there is this screening, also by the Senate Service Department.
Right. Those are employees.
That is correct. And they are employed by the Rules Committee. Now, then there are two other restraining forces, it seems to me, and that is the Ethics Committee. Complaints may be referred to the Ethics Committee for disciplinary action. The statute that I referred to in 1973 establishes a whole procedure for due process and screening of any material that may be defamatory. So there is a self-policing process, and of course the major process with a legislator is supposed to be, the major restraining force is supposed to be the ballot box.
So Dr. Hutchinson should have gone to the committee. Ethics Committee or someplace in the Senate to complain.
Yes, he could have done that. As could any citizen. We've urged that the speech or debate clause must take into account how Congress actually operates. We've mentioned due deference. In the investigations conducted by Congress, this court has seemed to have shown the greatest amount of deference, even though that investigation might not be specifically authorized by Congress. Once an investigation has been determined that it is a matter upon which legislation may be had, this court has said it will not examine any further the conduct and that it is immune. We would say that the same principle ought to apply with respect to the informing function.
But hasn't that generally been applied to committee chairmen or committee activities rather than individual members of Congress?
No, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, I would not say that it has been most frequently is exercised by committee chairmen, but there has been no restraint on investigation by a particular member. In the Gravel case, in the investigation in that sense, there was to be no investigation, or the court ruled there would be no further investigation as to the motives of that member in preparing himself for the committee hearing. Now, also a distinctive feature in Gravel from this case, and it has been relied upon by petitioner, is that conduct, that is, secret material, was specifically proscribed by Congress. It's both its collection and its distribution. The distinction we believe that should be apparent in this case is that this particular material has been generally authorized by Congress, and the newsletters press releases have been specifically facilitated.
But you've already said that no one checks the content. Then how do you authorize the contents of a letter which the Congress has carefully, very carefully, said they would not censor, was the term you used.
It would not try to muzzle a particular member. That might be an abuse that this court would have to be resolved in the member's favor. But it does attempt to screen for facilitation or that the particular proscriptions in the 1973 Act have not been violated.
You're not suggesting that Congress could, by a legislative enactment, authorize a libel, as I think Mr. Justice White put it to you in different terms, extend the speech or debate immunity to something which it does not cover within the reach of that clause.
It may frequently and has in the past concern libel.
Well, Mr. Raywood, what if Senator Gravel's newsletter had contained the so-called secret information you referred to?
Then I expect the
reach of that clause.
It may frequently and has in the past concern libel.
Well, Mr. Raywood, what if Senator Gravel's newsletter had contained the so-called secret information you referred to?
Then I expect the screening process might have stopped its distribution.
Well, you said it doesn't censor.
I said it screens for conformance with its rules.
Well, what if something in the newsletter would violate Wisconsin law or local law?
So long as it serves a legitimate legislative need, and so long as the Congress has made that determination, it seems to me that due deference should be paid to that determination, and immunity would follow. And the Wisconsin law would have to give way.
So you think Congress did intend to authorize senators to, in their newsletter, to give them immunity, absolute immunity, for the grossest kind of defamation? That you think that was their intention in this legislation?
It sought to protect their communication with their constituents.
Well, yes or no, I would suppose my question can be answered.
In the extreme situation that you pose, yes. But there is broad definition there as to that the matters should relate to business before the Congress, to matters of broad public interest, to only state information where it bears upon the impact of national legislation.
What about the letters, the newsletters that went outside of Wisconsin? Senators don't have constituents in the technical sense outside of their own state, do they?
That is true. However, each senator, of course, has a national impact and votes on national issues. The actual facts there are that, and what Proxmire explained, was that he mails to his constituents. He also mails to those persons who have requested to be placed on his mailing list.
That might include quite a few newspapers, for example, and radio and television broadcasters.
That determination is made entirely separately, and those are the press releases. They are broadly distributed and are not confined to his state by any means. Petitioner has properly represented that they went to news media throughout the country. Constituents are another matter. The newsletters are another matter, and they are not sent as a matter of routine to the press and the media. There has been reliance placed on Story's interpretation of the Constitution and his early pronouncements as to whether or not speech or debate would cover speech or debate immunity would cover republication. On the very issue that you raised, Mr. Chief Justice, Story has an extended comment. I don't know whether we read different editions, but in the fifth edition, in section 866, and there is an extended footnote in which he says that Congress may have an immunity when they write to their constituents, report to their constituents, and he treats the very issue that you raised, that constituency should not be confined to his particular state. He ought to be able to reach and influence legislation beyond that state. And his immunity is perhaps so far as he accurately reports and does not defame. Now, Story goes on in the quote that has been cited in the reply brief, and then there's a caveat at the end of his long examination of speech and debate, which was not included in that quote. And he says that there are legal scholars that agree or that disagree on my interpretation of the English law and make a distinction in American law that because the Congress has mandated that all of its speeches and all of its proceedings, unlike the English law or Parliament, be made public, then the argument follows that speech or debate should follow a republication of official congressional business, whether it be speaking on the floor or whether it be a publication or distribution by that congressman of what he said on the floor.
Mr. Raywood, if gross defamation is not redressable because of speech and debate in a judicial proceeding, what can the Senate do about it?
I missed the first part. If
gross defamation is not to be, because of speech and debate, redressable in a judicial proceeding, is there anything the Senate can do?
The Senate can discipline its member. The Senate can...
That's all.
That's all. It cannot award damages, but it can...
It can't even vindicate the person's reputation, can it?
Well, I would say
there wouldn't be a trial or a hearing or anything.
Oh, yes, there has been established in the Ethics Committee a rather detailed procedure for of due process.
For participation by the victim of a libel, for example?
It does not specifically call for that. No, it does not. But his views might be expressed through committee counsel,
and
that would be in a sense.
How many members have been subject to that procedure?
I do not know. In the early history of the Congress, the disciplinary practice was quite common, and it certainly is increasingly so. Not as to the particular issue raised by Mr. Justice White.
Was the last one about 20 years ago? Most recent?
I do not know that how frequent it has been. Of course, the 1973 Act is rather new.
Mr. Raven, the trouble, what law of libel would you apply in the Senate?
None.
That's what I was worried about. I mean, you couldn't sue between Michigan and Wisconsin. You just had to get one out there.
We have argued that it is somewhat akin to judicial immunity.
Right.
The senators.
Right. So you don't get to the whether or not there's a libel.
Right.
I think when you get to whether or not there's a libel, you're going to be in trouble.
I disagree with you and the district court.
But you don't mind if we go the other way and say you don't touch it at all. You don't mind us going that way, do you?
It is correct, isn't it, Mr. Raywood, that in the disciplinary proceedings, for example, of Senator McCarthy, that the victims of his comments did have an opportunity in some cases to testify and to a certain extent vindicate their reputation.
Well, I think they had an opportunity, and I think they were called by committee counsel and a careful...
Whether it was an adequate opportunity is another issue, of course.
Excuse me?
Whether it was an adequate opportunity is another issue, of course.
Well, it certainly was not an open trial, but it was a due
but
process.
But that's the remedy that you say is available in this situation.
Yes.
And, but they were invited. They had no right to appear there.
Well, I'm quite certain they sought appearance.
Well, yes, but they were there at the sufferance of the committee.
At the sufferance of the committee.
Mr. Raywood, you haven't there, if you have, I missed it, mentioned the language in the court opinion in the Brewster case that explicitly and unambiguously said that newsletters and press releases are simply not covered by the speech and debate clause. Have you mentioned that?
Certainly have mentioned it extensively in the brief.
Yes, but
certainly
I don't
mentioned
remember.
It to the courts below. What
it wouldn't be up to you, I suppose, to emphasize it. That's
well, what we tried to point out in the courts below, and successfully so, that issue was not posed to the Brewster court, that was not contained in the Brewster case. They were talking about bribery. It might have been helpful in explaining the scope of legislative immunity in that particular case. We're not maintaining for unlawful conduct here that any specific activity proscribed by Congress itself should speech or debate immunity apply.
Criminal conduct. When you said unlawful conduct, you meant criminal conduct, did you?
Well, principally criminal conduct, but
because
it might...
Because the allegation is that the senator's conduct was unlawful as a matter of civil law.
Well, I'm talking about a prescription imposed by Congress itself.
Federal law.
Yes. But also in the Doe case, when the court was considering whether it was necessary to make a legitimate legislative need, in order to meet the Brewster language, we made an elaborate evidentiary showing, rather than the mere halting of immunity by simply the letter, as the Chief Justice suggested, might be filed. We made an extensive evidentiary showing to try and explain how Congress operates, how Congress conceives its own function, and in that manner hope to overcome that dicta and show that this was necessary to a legitimate legislative function.
The statements in the court's opinion in the Brewster case are clear and unambiguous, aren't they? They are, as you suggest, perhaps dicta.
They are.
But the court would certainly have to modify or amend those views, wouldn't it?
Well,
if you're correct.
To accept your
submission.
Well, we believe that a majority of the court has. The Brewster majority turned out to be the Doe minority. Mm-hmm. And they were talking in the Doe minority of the rights of Congress or the necessary function of Congress to inform. We think that seven members of this court have given more than adequate treatment to the informing function.
In Doe, the committee had authorized the publication, had it not?
Yes, it had.
The informing function of... Excuse me, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt. You can...
Well, I merely wanted to say that... Yes, and to that extent, we would say that in our per se application, that Doe should be extended. It was only, of course, the majority opinion there was written by only two justices and joined by an additional three. But I think the critical factor in Doe and the influential factor with the that made up the majority is that this was exposure for the sheer sake of exposure in violation of Watkins. And the court was offended by that. When in this particular case, it is so intimately tied to public spending and how these agencies and given to these particular agencies and authorized by Congress, those are distinguishing elements. But to the extent that we are contra to Doe, we would ask the court to modify.
Are you suggesting that in order to explain unwise public expenditures, it's necessary to libel someone in order to get attention? Is that the justification for the libel?
No, but as Mr. Justice White said, or I believe I'm properly paraphrasing him, that we may make the assumption that that it was libelous. No, I wouldn't say that was necessary, but neither does the court, it seems to me, want to get into the examination of each, the exercise of each congressman, how he feels he will reach the public, how he will influence legislation, how he will garner votes. If it is, it will be placing the legislature under the heel of the judiciary, and it will remove to a substantial degree the representation of Congress.
You say of the judiciary. I mean, basically, it's a question of Wisconsin tort law unless the Constitution prohibits it. It isn't certainly up to this court to kind of pull something out of the sky and say, yes, you can, or no, you can't.
Well, it may, that issue may never come to this court. It's true. But I would put no less weight on a possible hostile judiciary in the state of Wisconsin or any other state as curbing the activity of a congressman. It's equally important, it seems, to remove that from all courts.
Even for openly illegal activity?
Not for unlawful activity or activity prescribed by Congress. But where it is authorized...
There's a criminal libel law in the state. And this publication, anybody within his right mind would think is criminal libel. You say he's immune.
Yes, I would say he's immune. It sounds very much like sedition laws.
A criminal
to prosecute a congressman in issuing a letter in the manner prescribed by Congress and make that subject to a criminal libel law, yes. It seems to me akin to a sedition law.
Well, sedition, I thought, was criticism of the government.
Yes, and this, and I've stated in every one of these instances, or the conduct under review here, is conduct of criticism of the government.
Well, supposing a senator goes back to his home state and says, the guy who lives next to me in Madison is a real SOB.
He should bring an action against that congressman, and he should be prosecuted in those local courts. Without question.
So your doctrine would not extend that far?
It certainly would not.
That is sedition.
No, that's not sedition. That's the same if he ran over someone.
Very well.
You rely on, I'd like to ask the question, I've perhaps been too deferential. You rely a great deal in your brief on what you call the informing function of Congress to justify bringing the newsletters and press releases within the speech and debate clause. That function, which was emphasized by Woodrow Wilson and has been by many, many others, I'd always understood to be largely the function of Congress to inform itself in order to intelligently legislate. You rather understand it as a function of informing the public.
I don't believe, or certainly not my reading, Mr. Justice Stewart, of all of those treatises has narrowed it to Congress.
For congressional investigations by various committees and subcommittees, the basic justification is the informing of the members of Congress so that they can act intelligently in deciding whether or not to vote for or against proposed legislation, or even in framing the proposed legislation.
I think Mr. Justice Blackmun has best articulated our position on the informing function in his brief, or in his dissent in Doe. He characterizes that informing function in four different stages. He talks about the public getting word back from the public and the participation of the public and with their congressman, and how that influences legislation. I would say it was far beyond.
That was a dissenting opinion, correct?
It was a dissenting opinion, but as I've tried to point out, it seems to me that a number of dissenters in the varying opinions of the court have been very much conscious of the informing function, and they would make up, or which I invite, a new majority in recognizing the informing function.
That is, the informing of the public, not the informing of the members of Congress.
Most definitely.
It's both, at least. You would concede that, wouldn't you?
Oh, certainly. The other members play a definite part, and that was what Senator Proxmire said was important to us.
Well, I read Woodrow Wilson's essays as putting the emphasis on informing and educating the public, but that was a function of the Congress through its committees, not 100 individual senators and 435 individual congressmen running off on their own and having any immunity.
In the tier and the hierarchy and structure of the Senate, the members' rights have been protected and encouraged
by
the Senate rules. No one attempts to muzzle an individual senator. And in the investigative phase, it's pointed out by the Court of Appeals in the McShirley case. Some information must start with a particular senator. He receives some information, he asks an executive official, and that starts the process. It cannot all be formalized through subpoena to the by a committee or by the chairman of the committee. Otherwise, nothing really would get started except the most popular items.
We've detained you long enough now, counsel. We'll see if Mr. Kavanaugh has anything further.
Your Honors, Mr. Ray would just comment that this case does not involve a case of exposure for the sake of exposure. We would vigorously disagree with that. That appears to us to be exactly what occurred here. Senator Proxmire's avowed purpose was to award the Golden Fleece to funding agencies for the funding that they had granted. There was no need to name Dr. Hutchinson by name. There was no need to ridicule and humiliate Dr. Hutchinson. There was no need to send this press release, in addition to every newspaper and member of the media in the United States, to members of the press in Japan, Italy, Britain, and Canada. A senator's press releases may be entertaining to read, and they may be entertaining on television talk shows, but to the people in Kalamazoo, Michigan, to the victims in Madison, Wisconsin, and the victims in the other places in the United States, they're devastating. They humiliate, they ridicule, and they emotionally cripple. What can a man who's been a victim of one of these releases say to his children when he comes home? What can his children tell to their schoolmates? The court has always attempted to balance the interest of the individual and his reputation.
Well, you can tell them who to vote for, I guess.
But they don't allow
Michigan.
They don't allow Michigan citizens to vote in other states, do they?
That's right. Nor do they do those unfortunate people in Japan who receive these newsletters or the press releases.
Well, isn't the real damage that you're talking about is in the academic community and his professional reputation as a scientist to either within the country or out of the country if he has a wide enough reputation?
That certainly is a major element, but there also is damage just to the people who know Dr. Hutchinson as a person. In effect, a press release like this calls a man a charlatan or a fraud, accuses him of taking government money for doing worthless work. You could take the same approach and describe a scientist discovering penicillin as some charlatan taking money to watch bread mold. It's simply unfair, and what the Senate is asking us to do in this case is to totally disregard the balancing process that has occurred in the past and to grant senators absolute immunity for anything they say at any time and in any place, no matter how widely it is disseminated.
Mr. Kavanaugh, in your principal argument, I asked you about the public figure issue, and you helped me out there. What about the public official problem, which the court below did not reach? Wasn't your client a public official, as that term's been used in the cases?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe that he is. A public official has generally been defined as a person who occupies a high public position who would be the subject of interest without the controversy. In this case, Dr. Hutchinson was director of research at Kalamazoo State Hospital. He had 10 or 11 employees under his supervision. He could not hire, he could not fire. He had very little discretion. He could respond to a contract request from a federal agency, but he would respond to his employing department. He was no different in the type of position that he had, really, than someone who was director of nursing at the institution or director of physical facilities. That he is not the type of public official that I think the court had in mind in the cases where public officials spoken of. He was not an elected official.
Did you measure it by the number of persons under his supervision? Is that the test? Is
Your
it
Honor,
the importance of his responsibility?
I don't think that there is any one test. The number of people under him is a measure of his responsibility. If responsibility is the test, Dr. Hutchinson had no authority to spend the money that Senator Proxmire has referred to. It was sent to the state of Michigan, and the most that Hutchinson could do was to submit a purchase request or a voucher for payment of salaries. The people who controlled the funding were the funding agencies in Washington and then the agencies in Michigan that received the funds. Dr. Hutchinson was merely another civil service employee.
He was an officer of the state, wasn't he?
An officer of the state, sir?
Usually they are.
He was an employee of the state.
How is the senator or a congressman, however, who is focusing on some particular problem, how do you say he should inform his constituents or the broad constituency, which is the country?
Your Honor, he can inform without defaming. He should not need absolute immunity to say the boldest lie. It should be enough that he can tell the truth to his constituents or the other members of the nation. He certainly can say anything to federal to other congressmen and have absolute immunity.
Well, if he issued a press release, even a great many of them, simply stating all these facts that X hundred thousands of dollars were being done and reciting factually and accurately the nature of the research, how many members of the media would pay any attention to it?
Your Honor,
it's pretty dull stuff, wouldn't it?
It's difficult to say how many members of the media pay attention to one of his golden fleeces 2 weeks after it is issued. It's certainly sensational when it is issued, and it gets coverage simply because it is sensational, because of the witty things that it says. But, Your Honor, I'm not sure that that ultimately is given any more attention than would a factual, truthworthy, or truthful newsletter or a press release.
What do you say about the protection of a senator from having to go before a court on the island of Maui in the Hawaiian Islands and defend the statement that he made?
Your Honor, if he makes a statement, it is his obligation to defend it.
To go to Maui and defend it?
Your Honor, I would disagree with Mr. Raywood's statement that he does not even have to file an answer. I believe the law is that the senator does have to file an answer. He could raise speech and debate then if it's legitimate activity, and he certainly could ask to have the case moved to some other forum. But if the senator makes a defamatory statement and broadcasts it so widely that it reaches Hawaii, then I don't think it's unfair to initially require him to appear there through counsel to defend it.
But the clause, if it's within the clause says he may not be questioned. That literally means they can't even ask him a question on a deposition, on the witness stand in the courtroom, or anywhere else.
If it is within the privilege.
Yes.
And Congress could forbid any federal court from taking jurisdiction over a claim such as this against a member of Congress, could it not?
Your Honor, I don't believe Congress could, because if you said that Congress could do that, then you're saying that Congress has the power to rewrite the Constitution, and that Congress has the power to say how broad the protection is afforded by the speech or debate clause.
Oh, they're not rewriting the Constitution. They're simply saying that courts which they create lower federal courts shall not entertain particular types of action.
That's right.
Then, Your Honor, I presume our cause of action would be in a higher court, perhaps in front of this court.
It's simply under Article 3 that Congress has the power to create any inferior federal courts that it wants to and to allocate to them any jurisdiction that it wants to. That's all that my brother Rank was talking about,
yes.
I think.
But I don't think that that would deprive the victim of his right to appear in some court, perhaps state court, perhaps a higher federal court that Congress has not created.
They surely would have no jurisdiction under Article 3, any power under Article 3 to define state court jurisdiction.
That is right, Your Honor. That is absolutely correct.
And when a federal court sits on a state case diversity, it's a surrogate for a state court, is it not?
Yes, Your Honor.
And Congress could repeal diversity jurisdiction tomorrow.
Right. Congress has been urged to do it.
Yes. Your Honor, we would respectfully ask that the court reverse the lower decisions and permit Dr. Hutchinson to have his day in court so that he may vindicate his reputation.
Is the newspaper publishing a quote from the congressional record liable to the victim?
No, Your Honor. Generally, there is a privilege for the media to report.
So if the media takes the congressional record in which this Golden Fleece Award has been placed and publishes it in full, it's immune.
It would be, Your Honor.
Now, the senator, though, if he mails it out in his newsletter, the very same thing, a copy of the congressional record, you say he is not immune.
That is correct, Your Honor. There are two separate immunities. The senator's immunity is under the speech and debate clause. The press's immunity is the common law that has been developed. And the common law has recognized a qualified privilege for members of the media to accurately report what has taken place in Congress or in a court. But there are two separate immunities. With the senator, I think under Doe, if he publicizes the action taken or the speech made wider than is necessary for legitimate legislative needs, he has exceeded the speech or debate clause, and there is liability.
Well, the submission is, though, that the newsletters are an ordinary way of legislating.
Your Honor, we would respectfully disagree with that, that a newsletter to 100,000 people in Wisconsin and outside of Wisconsin is not within the legitimate legislative needs of Congress. It is a personal political act. Thank you very much.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear our argument next.